Reentry sequence, he'll do that and then give you a summary of the shift.
I have a lot of times for you. I guess my first question is whether you want them in GET or local time. Okay, well, let me do it in local time because probably people start being interested in that kind of a clock now. Mid-course 7 is now scheduled to be done, and in all probability we will have to do it, as I'll explain to you in a little while. That'll be done at 8:37 tomorrow a.m. It's kind of hard to read the second one. We separate from the service module at 11:22 a.m. We hit 400,000 feet at 11 hours, 37 minutes, and 57 seconds. We have drogues at 11:46:14. Yes?
Seven.
I was going to explain that when you finished. These were computed based on the original mid-course 6 plan. They checked a couple of the times and they only changed a second. I was going to caution you that at the end of this, these are probably good to plus or minus 2 seconds. Okay? I was at drogues at 11:46:14, mains at 11:47:02, with landing at 11:51:59. And there's several other numbers, and I'll just leave this paper here, a couple of copies of it. And I would say again that the numbers are good at this time to plus minus about 2 seconds or thereabouts, because of our change in mid-course plans. Okay, let me give you a summary of the shift as we did it. We came on this morning and, today was a fairly quiet day again, as the days on the Trans-Earth Coast have been. When we came online, they were just finishing up a fairly long period of having the number one fuel cell on the line. We extended the period this fuel cell was on the line by performing a hydrogen purge on it, which in effect cools the cell so that it was not heating up as fast, and we kept it online for about 3 hours to get some information on how long we could do that. And then we set up the PTC, and the first time we set it up, it started off a little bit poorly in that there were some rates just as we got started into it, and it didn't hold up very well. We got some thruster firings, but it was of no concern to us really because we were coming back out of it in about an hour to go to the P-23 work. We also found today that the hydrogen heaters were on auto, and they came on, and they stayed on. They didn't go off when they should have. A little pressure switch in the hydrogen tank is supposed to tell them when to shut off, and something in its circuitry was not working properly. We don't yet know what. However, so in order to satisfy ourselves that it wasn't just that it was an accidental occurrence or whatever, we did it again, and again the heater stayed on under the automatic control of the pressure circuitry. So we've taken them out of auto, and we're just going to play them manually from now on. And what we're going to do with them tonight is just turn one fan on in the one hydrogen tank, and that'll keep the pressure rising all night, but at a nice slow rate such that we will stay within the operating range of the tank all night while the men are sleeping. We did some P-23 work, which amounts to mid-course navigation work, on the way back, and we had various conversations with John Young about how well the navigation was coming out. In general, it was hitting within about 10 miles to 15 miles of the vacuum perigee that we were predicting here at Earth, predicting here with the MISFIN tracking. However, this tracking that was being done today was not designed for the the highest accuracy that you can get with the onboard system. The test was deliberately being done with stars which were out of plane and bringing them down to the horizon, with the horizon being very close to the terminator. So it was a deliberate test of probably the most inaccurate set of geometry that you can set up for the onboard system. And even at that, it was solving the problem within the corridor width, just about. Early in the day, because of the rather long hydrogen purge on the fuel cell, which we don't ordinarily do at all. We saw some deviations on our Doppler tracking data indicating that we didn't have a good model for what was happening there in the trajectory. Based on that, we rather early in this shift delayed the mid-course a half hour in order to allow another half hour of tracking before we committed to doing the mid-course. I'll talk to you in a little while about our eventual decision, which was to scrub the mid-course for today. Okay, at about 172 or thereabouts, the pilots went back into the PTC after the P-23 work, the mid-course navigation work, and we went on with passive thermal control for a while, and that was set up very nicely. We had an unscheduled TV pass for about 10 or 15 minutes at 173 and a half hours. And I guess that you could just call that courtesy of Tom Stafford. We, after 174 hours at about 174 and a half, we got back into another set of star marks for P-23, and we got essentially the same results as we got on the set a couple hours previous to that. We set up the spacecraft with everything that was required to do the mid-course 6, but by that time we still were not satisfied that the Doppler residuals, which is a measure of how closely the observed readings are jibing with what the model says the Doppler ought to be at that time. We were not satisfied that these readings were damping out enough. Therefore, there was some concern that perhaps we did get a trajectory effect from the purge that we did, where we were, in effect, thrusting by spilling the hydrogen overboard, although it was at a very, very low level, and also by the small amount of water boiling that we did when we powered up the secondary evaporator. So based on that, we began to look at a reasonable probability that we would have to do mid-course 7 tomorrow anyway. And based on that reasonable probability, we will be in a better posture tomorrow to do a more accurate mid-course 7 by not having done mid-course 6 today, so that in effect we'll have about 16 hours of continuous track since we had that interruption due to the purge, instead of taking a mid-course today and then essentially starting the tracking over again and ending up with about half the tracking time. So we're trying to make mid-course 7 now that we have to make it as accurately as possible, and the best way to do that was to skip mid-course 6. And we have practiced mid-course 7, as Tom pointed out today. You probably heard him or read in the transcript that 3 hours probably prior to entry. We had had on Apollo 8, we had a mid-course scheduled 2 hours prior to entry, but that just seemed a little bit too tight. And we've moved back to 3 hours prior to entry on this flight, and that's a reasonably comfortable timeline for us and the pilots to live with. You heard some remarks here late in the day from the pilots about closing in on the Earth now. They are going to start accelerating pretty quickly in the last 15 to 16 hours, and certainly a good deal right at the very end, the last couple hours of the flight. The crew set the alarm clock for us at 185 tomorrow. Everything in the spacecraft outside of the fuel cell number 1, which we still have offline, is performing just about on the money. The passive thermal control is being set up again for tonight. We expect to have the same kind of performance that we've had in that mode over the last couple nights on the Trans-Earth Coast. That is that we have very few, if hopefully none at all, thruster firings and no fuel usage. And that's about it. The pilots will wake up tomorrow at 185 hours. We have mid-course 7. I believe it's at 188 and a half. Is that right? No, 188.50. Let me correct that. It'll probably turn out to be 188.48, to be exact, mid-course 7. Crew will trim the residuals on that burn, and then we're just essentially in the final checks for the configuration of the spacecraft for entry. We do intend to reservice the primary evaporator tomorrow and bring it online for the entry phase. As you recall from the launch phase and going into lunar orbit, we have not had that evaporator stay online very long. It seems to be drying out. However, with the resurfacing we're going to do, we'll figure that there'll be enough water in there that it ought to last for enough time to get us through entry tomorrow. Although even if it doesn't work as it did on Apollo 8, that is of no real concern. We have the secondary evaporator even if that were not to work, you can fly the reentries reasonably comfortably without any evaporation at all. That's about all. Today was a quiet day for the pilots. I think they spent most of their time just going over what they have to do tomorrow. The activity tomorrow will be fairly busy, I think, especially in the cockpit with the work that has to be done in there. That about summarizes what I have, and I will go from questions.
Harry?
Could you give us a ballpark idea of what the burn will be on the final mid-course?
Yes. Right now, it looks like it'll be on the order of a foot per second.
And what kind of cabin temperatures would you guess at? I mean, how much rise in cabin temperature during reentry might result from having both evaporators off the line or one?
I don't know, Harry. But it remains within comfortable limits, so I guess it might. I don't know how much it would go up, but certainly not more than 20 degrees. Not more than. It may only go up 2, even without the evaporators.
Questions that you can answer real quickly, if you can answer them. Do we know yet how close they came to the moon in feet on the DOI pass? I know you're waiting for data. Okay. Two, what's the other one? Oh, the predicted time, you may have given it, but if you did, I missed it. I came in late for ETA tomorrow, splashdown.
11:51:59, 11:52 Central Daylight.
Go ahead, Al.
Do you have a time for a total distance traveled on this space flight? How many miles they have traveled, or do you have a computer that could conveniently figure that out?
We don't have that figure now. I don't know whether they'll have computer time tomorrow to figure that out or not. We can make the request.
Well, why don't we ask over there tonight? Maybe they can have it by tomorrow.
Go ahead.
Can you tell me what happened to the 12 minutes that we lost earlier in the mission? You seem to have made this up plus another minute somewhere.
Pardon?
You seem to have made up the 12 minutes.
Oh, yes,
that we lost,
yes, we
plus
made
another
it up.
One. Where did you make that up?
With the TEI burn. With the burn that we did coming out from behind the moon.
Yeah, okay. Secondly, how large is the reentry window?
Say again?
How large is the reentry window? What area does it cover?
Oh, we have limits on it, as I recall, in the order of about a half a degree in flight path angle. There's another way to look at it, which perhaps is more understandable for you. And that is in terms of the vacuum perigee that we have when we come back. By vacuum perigee, I mean if there were no atmosphere and we skimmed on by the Earth just like one does at the moon, you would hit the middle of the window when you had a vacuum perigee of 20 miles. That is a perigee which would be undisturbed by the atmosphere. And we predict this ahead now, and you hear us talking about vacuum perigees. That's what we're talking about. It's just a measure of the trajectory you're on. And the limits on that are approximately plus or minus 15 degrees. Okay? It's a little bit more on one side than the other, but approximately 15 degrees on either side of that 20 is where you want the trajectory to go. Okay?
One final one. Can you tell me what the rate of acceleration in the last 2 hours in feet per second?
No.
I mean, what is it just prior to re-entry into atmosphere,
oh,
as opposed to what it would be 2 hours?
It's going about 36,300 feet per second at entry. That's at 400,000 feet.
What was Apollo 8's re-entry speed?
Say again?
What was Apollo 8's re-entry speed?
It was just about the same, give or take a few.
When you're talking about the hydrogen purge, did you get a measurable delta V for that thing?
Did we get a...
When you were talking about the hydrogen purge and your MISFIN data, did you actually get an acceleration that could be measured by ground tracking?
Surprisingly, yes, the accelerations that you get from those kind of forces are extremely low, but if you propagate them over a long period of time, it shows up in that the observed Doppler rate is not what the computed rate says it ought to be. So you start, and we set these limits real tight, and you start seeing an observed minus computed rate deviate from the zero, okay, the zero point. So you see it relatively quickly. You can see water dumps and everything in the tracking.
But what was it on this? What was the velocity change on the hydrogen purge?
Oh, we would estimate it to be on the order of a tenth of a foot per second, and it was done at a PTC attitude, so it was kind of spread around, but you can still see the effect in the Doppler. As a matter of fact, on the Doppler, it's so sensitive that you can tell when the vehicle's rolling when they switch from one omni to another, as a matter of fact. So it's pretty sensitive stuff.
Hurt.
Glenn, do you happen to know what the history of the shaving equipment was? There seemed to be some surprise expressed at Mission Control. It wasn't in the personal hygiene list, kit. Was it authorized equipment?
Yes, it was authorized. It was carried in the personal preference kit. It was authorized by the program. It was requested, actually, by the pilots as a test to find out whether we could shave that way and without getting into some fancy development on a razor. And it turns out, apparently, that they shaved very nicely with the lather and the razor.
Do you know how many there were? Were there a razor for each and a shaving cream?
No, I don't.
You don't know how much?
I would suspect that they passed the razor, but that's a guess on my part.
You have any idea what they cost?
What the what?
How much they cost?
As much as they cost you and me.
Just an ordinary drugstore razor?
Yes, sir. I don't know.
Deke Slayton bought the razor for them in a drugstore.
He actually bought it.
Yes, I'm serious.
Jack, do you have any idea how many electric shaving models were developed and tried and what they cost?
No, I don't. The query desk could find out for you, I'm sure, from the crew systems division, but I don't have any idea.
Do any of these pilots ordinarily shave with a straight razor, and if not, was there a training program involved?
It wasn't a straight razor, it was a safety razor.
Oh, okay.
Glenn, in previous three previous Apollos, we always seemed to come up a little bit extra, getting more than 100% of objectives. What did you come up with extra on this flight, if anything?
Would you believe 110?
What was the 10?
I didn't bring it over here with me, but the fellows who keep track of that went through and summarized it all and put their little numbers on it, and that's what they came up with, Mark. And it was mostly additional things like the TV, some of the PTC things we did, some of the things we were able to do with the LAM after we sent it on its way, etc. Okay. But I'll take 100% every time. That suits me fine as a number.
Is 110 the best yet?
I believe it is according to that system of keeping score.
Was this a Gillette razor?
Oh, no.
I know I said a dirty word, but...
No, I don't know, Harry. I don't know what it was.
We don't know what brand of razor it was.
As a matter of fact, it's just as well I don't.
And do you have any idea why they waited this long to shave when they were itching and uncomfortable for so many days?
I don't know, but they'll be here and you can ask him.
I don't care about the brand names, but I would like to know what kind of shaving cream, was not a foaming type of cream, was it?
It was a tube of brushless shaving cream.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes. Purchased at the same drugstore they purchased the razor.
We expect a shaving commercial pretty soon on a TV show, you think?
I don't think so.
Okay, thank
All
you.
All done. See you tomorrow.
Hey, let me leave you these things. Just leave.